while regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Hopefully you had a good Easter weekend. It was good here. I mean, you know, too old for Easter egg hunts, both myself and my kids, but it was a good weekend. And I appreciate you being here today. We're going to be talking with Dr. Michael Siegel from Tufts University here in just a moment or two about the Bridging the Divide program. You know, we've talked with David Yamane about this. He was one of the panelists. I've read about this quite a bit at Bearing Arms. This was the program designed by Dr. Siegel to come up with. And I'm paraphrasing David Yamane's statement and a couple of the other panelists. It was basically designed to come up with a way for red states to embrace some gun control measures, measures that Dr. Siegel believes are effective in preventing both violent crime, suicides with firearms, accidents involving firearms. While at the same time offering some bennies, right? So, for example, establishing a period, let's say 5 years, where individuals convicted of a violent misdemeanor could not possess a firearm. In exchange, getting rid of laws that ban nonviolent felons from being able to possess firearms. Focusing on the bad apple gun dealers, right? While at the same time providing state level protections for the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. I've taken a look at these proposals. We're not going to get into a big policy debate with Dr. Siegel. I have talked about my problems with these proposals, with the proposals overall. But I did want to talk to Dr. Siegel. He had reached out to me, and I wanted to talk to him about. Again, the purpose behind this, and I'll be honest with you. I mean, I think this kind of gets it backwards. And Dr. Siegel has talked about how he doesn't believe that gun bans are effective, magazine bans are effective. So rather than try to start with getting red states to embrace the gun laws that Dr. Siegel thinks are effective, I mean, I wonder why not try to build some credibility by working to repeal some of the gun laws in blue states that Dr. Siegel thinks are not effective. But anyway, it's a good conversation. I appreciate Dr. Siegel joining us, and I think you'll really enjoy the conversation. Before we get started, though, I do have to mention, I think on Thursday's Cam and Company, I said that the Supreme Court was not meeting in conference last week because of Good Friday. I was wrong about that. They did meet in conference. They did not grant any new asserts to Second Amendment cases. They did, however, deny Schoenthal versus Raul, which I feel like I want to channel my inner Donald Trump and let loose some F-bombs here. I am so frustrated by this. Schoenthal versus Raul is the case involving the ban on lawful carry on public transportation in the state of Illinois and the rule forbidding this on Chicago Transit Authority property. A district court judge found that law to be unconstitutional. The Seventh Circuit reversed the district court judge and said, oh, no, it's fine, because there's a national tradition of banning firearms in government-owned property, in banning firearms in crowded public spaces, and banning firearms where vulnerable populations may exist. And taken together, my gosh, well, look at this. You got a government-owned facility, right, or government-owned transit system that can be crowded, so lots of people around, and vulnerable populations like children and the elderly are often present. So, yeah, of course you can ban concealed carry there. The Supreme Court said in Bruin that you can't simply declare some place to be sensitive because there are a lot of people there and it's generally protected by the police. They noted that the bans on carrying and government property was essentially limited to courthouses and polling places. And yet, the Supreme Court has allowed that deeply flawed Seventh Circuit decision to stand. The state of Illinois had argued, listen, there's no circuit court split. Every court that has addressed this issue has said, yes, these bans are fine. As far as I know, the Seventh Circuit was the only one to do so post-Bruin, except that the Fourth Circuit also recently declared this to be hunky-dory as well in a case challenging the ban on concealed carry, I believe, in the metro system that serves D.C., Northern Virginia, and Maryland. So without a circuit court split, it is far less likely that the court is going to grant cert. And I understand that. I don't like it, but I understand it. But I also really do think that the court has to address this sooner rather than later, and it should have been sooner rather than later. Not only from a constitutional standpoint do I believe that the Seventh Circuit's decision is, again, deeply, deeply flawed, but from a pragmatic standpoint, I have been covering crimes on CTA property even before the Schoenthal case made it up to the Supreme Court, but certainly since then. I have made a habit of reporting on crimes on CTA property, whether it's robberies, stabbings, shootings, cases where someone's been set on fire. A crime on the CTA was so bad that the Trump administration actually told the city of Chicago, you better do something about this or we're going to yank your tens of millions of dollars in federal transportation funding. The Chicago police ended up surging officers onto CTA property, but and crime has gone down since then. But A, that's a temporary fix, and B, even if crime has gone down, it's certainly not non-existent. This policy endangers people. It also creates a two-tiered system of the right to carry, where if you can afford a car to get around, or you take the trouble of having a car in a major urban area, you get to exercise your right to carry. Right. If you go to a sensitive place, if you go to a place where firearms are prohibited, generally you can leave that firearm locked in your car while you're there. And then you get back and you put your gun on and you go about your day. If you're dependent on public transportation or you, you know, ride public transportation because you want to be good for the environment, whatever. You are disarmed throughout the entirety of your day. At least if you have to use public transportation. Now, under Illinois law, you are technically allowed to carry that firearm with you, but it has to be unloaded, locked up in a hard case while you're on public transportation. And then, of course, the question becomes, all right, so what do you do after you get off that bus or that train with your carry-on bag, with your pistol? How do you carry that concealed? How do you put it back on in a crowded public space without, again, alarming people? Right. So you are essentially disarmed throughout much of your day. And that is the system that the Supreme Court has allowed to stay in, to stay in place. I won't say that the Supreme Court endorsed that system because denial of cert doesn't mean that the court necessarily agrees. As Justice Kavanaugh pointed out when they denied cert in Snoop versus Maryland last year. But it does allow the status quo to stay in effect. And in this case, the status quo is harming people. It's harming those people who choose to carry in violation of the law and risk getting arrested and being convicted of a crime. I believe it's a felony in Illinois. It risks, puts the lives of people who don't exercise the right to carry at risk and who are disarmed and defenseless throughout the entirety of their days. I know the legal rationale for not granting cert, but to me, there is a constitutional and a moral rationale for accepting this case and striking down the ban. So I am very frustrated by the Supreme Court's inaction today. All right, let's set it aside. And let's kick off our conversation with Dr. Michael Siegel from Tufts University. Is there a way to bridge the divide between gun control advocates and Second Amendment advocates? I have my doubts. Take a look and a listen. Dr. Siegel, thanks so much for coming on the program today. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too, and thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You know, I talked with David Yamane not long ago about bridging the divide. I've had some email back and forth with a couple of the other panelists, but I really appreciate you joining me so we can, you know, kind of get all of this information directly from the guy who put this together. So I guess the first question is, what is your goal with bridging the divide?
So I have noticed in, you know, I've been doing research in firearm space for about 13 years or so. Most of my work has been on the effects of state level firearm laws. And I've noticed that there are a lot of laws that, although apparently intended to reduce firearm injury, aren't actually effective in doing that. But what they do is to inconvenience firearm owners, or even worse, to actually take away rights, constitutional rights. And that didn't make sense to me. As I started to learn more about firearms, I started to realize that we need to have the gun owning community at the table, because we in public health, for the most part, don't know anything about firearms. And I had to spend a lot of time getting rid of my own ignorance about it by, you know, immersing myself in gun culture, visiting gun stores, going to a shooting range, shooting a gun for the first time. And what I discovered was really fascinating. A lot of the regulations regarding firearms are really misguided, not because necessarily the intentions are bad, but because we don't know much about what we're regulating. And so it occurred to me that there's really a lot of room for compromises, for changes in the laws that actually, you know, have much more of a laser focus on where can we have an impact in reducing gun-related harms, rather than just kind of, you know, let's get rid of guns, let's get rid of assault weapons because it makes us feel better. And that was my goal. My goal was, let's bring gun owners and non-gun owners together. Let's sit them at the table. Let's talk to people who really know what they're talking about, who really understand, you know, what's a Form 4473? How does an exchange work? And let's really sit down and try to solve this together.
Okay, so I want to talk about the laws that you do think, or at least the programs that you do think are successful at reducing harms. But let's talk for a second about the laws that you kind of say maybe good intentioned. I would say in some cases I don't think they are good intentioned.
Fair enough.
But let's talk about the laws and the tactics that you feel are not successful at reducing harms. What are some of the things you're talking about here?
So, you know, I'll tell you the first one that comes to mind is really assault weapon bans. And I'll be very honest and transparent. When I started doing firearms research, you know, I kind of joined the anti-gun community, if you want to call it that. And I went along with it. You know, I thought, oh my God, assault weapons, this is terrible. I just kind of went along with the rhetoric. I knew nothing about what they were. And then the first time I ever went into a gun store, I went in and, the dealer actually, it was an FFL, spent about an hour with me, very, very generous with his time. And I said, I'd like to see what an assault weapon is. He brought out a gun, said, this is an assault weapon. I said, okay, well, you know, show me something that's similar to this, but would not be an assault weapon. He goes into the back room, he comes back and he brings out the exact same gun. And he says, okay, this is not an assault weapon. I said, wait a second, you're playing a trick on me. You know, it's the same gun. He said, well, it's not, it is the same gun, but there's a screw. He put a screw through the stock. So basically what was a folding stock, essentially was no longer folding. And so according to Massachusetts law, because it no longer had that quote feature that makes it an assault weapon, it was no longer an assault weapon. And that, you know, that kind of opened my eyes. And I realized, you know, what are we doing here? Regulating a gun based on whether there's a screw or not. And that made no sense. So that's, I mean, the first, I think, most blatant example is assault weapon bans. The second one, just as another example, is the ban on gun possession by people who use marijuana. I mean, that's, to me, that is a great, great violation of Second Amendment rights that, I mean, there's no explanation. You know, you can't even make the argument that, oh, well, somebody who's using marijuana is at greater risk. You know, if anything, they're at a lot less risk because they're just mellowing out someplace. And so it doesn't make any sense. And I looked at Form 4473 and, you know, you get to question 21, I think it's 21C, And basically, unless you lie, you're kind of in a catch-22, because if you say you use marijuana and you can't have a gun, if you say you don't, but you actually do, then you've committed a felony. To me, that's a blatant violation of Second Amendment rights. So that's a second one that kind of woke me up. And the third one is the fact that if you're a violent felon, if you're a nonviolent felon, you can't have a gun. But if you're a violent misdemeanant, you can. And it seems to me it should be the opposite. Why should somebody who didn't commit any violent crime, be deprived of Second Amendment rights essentially for life? But somebody who actually, assaulted someone, is there's no questions asked. You can, just go ahead and buy a gun. So a lot of these are examples of the things that just didn't make any sense to me. And that's where I thought there's room for compromise. If we can ease up some of those restrictions and really kind of laser focus on where it is that we can have the greatest impact, I think we can actually get people to agree on something.
And it sounds like, you did get your panel to agree on most of these proposals that came out of their sessions. So let's talk again about the other side. So one of the things that did emerge in this final blueprint was what you just talked about, right? Allowing nonviolent felons to possess firearms. But if you're convicted of a violent misdemeanor, not a permanent ban on owning guns, right? I think the blueprint calls for like a 5 or 6 year prohibition on possessing firearms, right? So that's one area. What are the other areas that you do think can make a difference, unlike, bans on so-called assault weapons and things of that nature?
So I think one area that is an area that would make a big difference is basically making it possible to do background checks for anyone who purchases a gun. And what we did in this law package was, I think for the first time ever, we created a system that is an automated approval check that anybody can access. So including private sellers, and essentially get a red light or a green light instantaneously without transmitting any personal information, without having a registry of the gun. It's basically just a red light or green light system, and any private seller can access it. And we decided that would, allow for private sales to take place without the hassle of having to bring them to an FFL. I mean, there's a lot of states right now where, you can't sell a gun unless you actually go through an FFL. And if you're in a rural area, it could be 4 or 5 hours to get to an FFL. And that just didn't seem to make sense. And most likely, I'm sure in a lot of those situations, it's people are just going to be lazy and they're scared. I'm not going to drive 5 hours. I'll just just meet me in the back, So this kind of allows us to get past that by saying, well, here's a mechanism that you can check. We also get by the problem of having a registry, which I think is problematic in many states, because there's no real personal information. It could be done through a driver's license. You just look up the number. So that's so I think this background check idea, the way that we fashioned it, makes it workable. Another example are the extreme risk protection order, red flag laws. I know that there's a lot of concern about these laws, understandably, because of things like due process. And what we tried to do in our version of this was two things. One, to really build in the strongest due process protections that I've seen in any of these laws. But the second thing, maybe more importantly, is that our law really looks at the person as a whole and not just the firearms. It struck our panel that if somebody is in such a bad enough situation that we've got to take their firearms, we're worried about them enough that we're going to take their firearms, then, well, shouldn't we also worry about they might do something else to harm themselves? And to just walk in, take the firearms and say, okay, have a good day, we'll see you in court, doesn't make sense to our panel. And so what we did is we basically have a set of interventions, including mental health treatment at the state's expense, So basically, we're saying, you know, look, if we're going to take your firearm and take your Second Amendment rights away, we're also going to offer you treatment at our expense, you know, an exam referral, and we're going to address other possible risks of suicide. What else is in your house that could be dangerous?
You know, and I completely agree with that, because that is, to me, one of the major flaws. You know, we can talk about the ex parte hearings. In many states, you know, because this is a civil entity, you know, you're not entitled to a public defender if you can't afford to hire an attorney. You know, there are a couple of states that actually do, you know, provide legal representation. But to me, yeah, that's the biggest issue that you, you know, just address here. If someone is a danger to themselves or others, why do we think that the problem gets solved when we just take away their guns and leave them access to car keys, matches, gasoline, what, knives in their kitchen, whatever, right? And so, you know, I wonder, Dr. Siegel, if, you know, if that isn't even better being framed as a, you know, a non-gun intervention, but almost sort of an intermediate step between doing nothing and an involuntary commitment. Right.
I think that's exactly what it is. I think that's a perfect way to describe it. The problem is that we can't involuntarily commit every single person who is at risk of suicide. I mean, we'd fill our hospitals or wherever, you know, psychiatric institutions. It would just be it would be unrealistic. But there has to be something. So there has to be something short of involuntary commitment. But it's also not enough to just say, okay, we're going to take away your gun. If somebody's really at that risk. So I think the way our panel fashioned this, it really is what you're saying. It's like, let's come up with an alternative to involuntary commitment that is in between doing nothing, or in between just taking the firearm and involuntary commitment. And so in our policy, there's crisis intervention. There's developing a crisis intervention plan. There's addressing other risks. There's, as I said, the mental health treatment. And, you know, in addition, there is the opportunity to involve family. In a lot of the states that have these laws, you know, your guns are basically confiscated by law enforcement. And then in our scenario, you know, you can give it to a trusted friend or family member so that they can actually be part of the process, and it's not as punitive and it's more protective.
Does the model policy that you guys came up with, does it limit who can apply for a petition?
So we allow for family members, law enforcement, and certain what we call secondary responders. And that includes like school personnel, mental health personnel. There are restrictions, though. So, for example, there's training that you need to go through before you can actually do that. So, some teacher somewhere can't just report somebody there. You have to go through a training to be able to identify how do you identify certain people and to understand how the law works. I do want to add, though, that there are also penalties for people who falsely, if you report somebody falsely, I mean, you're just trying to get someone's gun taken away, or you're trying to get back at someone for something. There are civil penalties for doing that. And so, you know, we're trying to really, really dissuade that type of behavior.
You know, I'm curious to get your opinion on how we've seen the existing red flag laws sort of expand in some of the states. Colorado, for instance, this year is, I think, likely to pass a bill that allows for institutions to petition for an ERPO. And Colorado is one of those states that allows for penalties if you file a false report. I've been asking, so who gets punished if an institution files a false report? And I can't find the answer to that. You've also got states like New York. Governor Hochul, I believe, after the top shooting in Buffalo, basically directed the New York State Police, file an ERPO every time you can. And at one point, the police were collecting so many firearms, they didn't have a place to store them all. You know, is that the wrong? Let me put it this way. Do you have concerns over how some states are implementing red flag laws?
Yes, I do. I think that, you know, the ERPO has a particular use, and there needs to be a very, you know, clear understanding among law enforcement, among other reporters, of the proper and improper use of the law. And one of the things that I think has to be done is to have training. You can't just implement this law and say, you know, okay, here it is, you know, and law enforcement, from now on, you know, implement this. There needs to be training. So in our proposal, we spent a lot of effort on conducting training so that, you know, pretty much anyone who is going to be a reporter has to be trained first. And I think that, you know, it's very easy to misuse these laws. And so, we also have an evaluation every year, an annual evaluation, which I think is critical, so that at least you can correct course. If something is going off the rails, there's a way to correct course, and there's a way for people to give input, so that that correction can be done.
I mean, you know, one of the concerns that I have is it just seems like the metric for success that many states put in place is how many ERPO orders have been issued, right? And if not enough have been issued, well, that's why we got to expand who can, you know, file for a petition. We have to make it easier to apply for one. And, you know, I remember when this first became a topic of conversation, the way supporters talked about red flag laws, kind of the way Democrats used to talk about abortion in the 90s, right? They wanted it to be safe, legal, and rare. And I think the rare has kind of dropped off the radar in a lot of states where these laws are already in place.
You know, these are meant for very specific situations, which I think you described it best, as the best that I've heard, which is essentially in situations where really what you would want to do is an involuntary commitment. That's where these laws should be used. You know, if it's a situation where you wouldn't commit the person, then the question arises, well, okay, why, you know, why do we need to do this? If it's not that severe a threat, you know, if they're really a threat. So that's the way I see it. And I think that, but that takes a lot of education for people to understand the concept behind it. And I, you know, I think maybe that's part of the problem is that we haven't really talked about what is the concept behind what you're doing. And honestly, it wasn't until I got to the table with gun owners at the panel, and they expressed, you know, the first question they asked was, if you're, you know, if somebody is in that situation, why not commit them? Or, you know, why just take their firearms? And when I started thinking about that, it really changed my own thinking about the place that these ERPO laws play. But I think we need to do that, you know, nationally and have a better understanding of what is the role of these laws and where are they appropriate and where are they not appropriate.
Yeah. And is the answer to why we don't commit people in these situations, is it primarily because we don't have the resources? I mean, I have done reporting on this. I mean, I look at every state in the nation, I think, has a shortage of acute inpatient mental health facilities. In Virginia, my neighbor's actually the county sheriff here. And, you know, he talks about deputies that are waiting in hospital rooms or hospital, ER waiting rooms for 24 or 48 hours because, you know, that's the option, right? You can take them back to jail, but that's not really where they need to be. Or you can wait for a space to open up, which can take days. And in the meantime, that individual in crisis is basically essentially stuck there in the ER. And that is a reality, right? I mean, I would prefer to see a fully functional mental health system. But in the absence of that, is this the, and I'm talking specifically about the red flag law that you guys have designed, is that sort of the real world best option to deal with this flawed system that we have right now?
You know, that's the way we view it. It is, you're absolutely right. There is a horrendous lack of mental health treatment in this country. And you're absolutely right. I can tell you in Massachusetts right now that if somebody is involuntarily committed today, they will be in the emergency room for at least 4 days. And that's if they're lucky. I mean, that's if they're lucky. You know, I've seen patients in for 2 weeks. That is no way to run a mental health treatment system. And so that, because that's the way the situation is, we really do need something in between. You know, there needs to be something in between doing nothing and putting somebody in the emergency room for 2 weeks. It just, there's got to be a middle ground. And that's kind of that's where we tried to laser focus our proposal, is to give us something in the middle. I mean, I think one could argue that if we had a functioning mental health care system, we probably wouldn't need these laws, because we would be able to give everybody the mental health treatment that they need. But unfortunately, that's not the way that we've, set up our system here.
Yeah. Well, and I will say that, as far as specifically the Second Amendment goes, an involuntary commitment triggers a lifetime ban on owning a firearm, whereas red flag laws do not. So, I have my issues with red flag laws, but, if, again, this is going to be an intermediate step, at least it does not involve the permanent loss of your Second Amendment rights. Before we run out of time, and I really appreciate you joining, I can talk to you about this stuff for hours, so we might have to have you back for a part two at some point. But
absolutely.
One of the things that both BJ and David Yamane had mentioned to me is that sort of the guiding philosophy when the stakeholders were sitting at the table together was, what policies can we get red states to accept? Is that a fair premise, you think?
Yeah, absolutely. That was part of what we were doing. I mean, I went in with the charge to the panel of saying, look, the goal here is not to figure out what Massachusetts should be doing, or, to try to strengthen Massachusetts laws, or New York, New Jersey, Hawaii, or Illinois, that's not what this is for. We are trying to figure out what we can do to save lives in states that, traditionally haven't made this a priority, often because of the, political or partisan nature of this. And so let's try to do this in a way that's not partisan, that's not, one side versus the other. And then, maybe this can gain some traction in those states. But absolutely, that was part of the purpose, is let's really focus on, the way we see things, based on my research, is that we have, essentially two dividing countries. We have, the country of Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, and Illinois, where you get stronger and stronger and stronger laws that, I won't go into detail, but in my opinion, in Massachusetts, it's just gone too far right now. And then other states are basically doing nothing. We'd rather see some middle ground where everybody can offer both protection from gun-related harms and protection of Second Amendment rights.
So if I could offer some constructive criticism.
Absolutely. We're always happy to hear that.
I think one of the things that this group is doing, because this is so new, you need to build credibility, right? And I think that you're trying to build credibility with gun owners. I think there needs to be at least equal emphasis on getting rid of the policies that you don't think make any sense at all in these blue states. Because right now what you're doing is essentially saying, okay, red states, we want you to accept on some level red flag laws, banning violent misdemeanors from owning firearms, universal background checks. But we're not asking the blue states to do anything. You can keep your assault weapon bans, you can keep your magazine bans, you can keep your waiting periods, you can keep all of these things. And I think it would be, I think it really would help this group gain credibility if, and not just reaching out to, Wisconsin lawmakers about, hey, here's what needs to be in place, if we think in your state, but to talk to Democrats in Massachusetts and say, hey, here's what needs to come off of the books. Here's what needs to be repealed. Here's what we think is wasting people's time, needlessly putting people in prison. They're destroying lives, right? There's a cost to all of these laws. And if the laws are not beneficial, then people are being hurt by these laws. So do you think there's room for bridging the divide to be just as active in blue states getting rid of some of these laws as in red states trying to put some of these policies in place?
I do think that's a fair, I think that's a fair criticism. And I think that it's very clear that our panel in making these recommendations for red states, even though we didn't actually make recommendations for blue states, I think it is very clear that the panel feels that these are the...
We're going to hold on a second here and see if Dr. Siegel comes back or if the technical difficulties got in the way of a response to the question that I was asking. And I don't know that Dr. Siegel is going to be coming back here, at least on this segment. I'm going to keep monologuing for just a second, just in case he does. But all right, I'm going to give it to the count of 10, and then I think we're going to have to call it. I do appreciate Dr. Siegel joining us on the program, and we may very well have to have him back at some point, but I'm going to go ahead and in this broadcast or in the recording here, and we'll see if we can pick this up again with Dr. Siegel at some point in the near future. All right. Well, I do want to thank Dr. Siegel for joining on the program. I heard from Dr. Siegel just a second ago, and apparently his computer decided to reboot in the middle of our conversation. So thanks, technology. Anyway, we may actually continue this conversation. I'll be honest with you. I had sort of planned on putting this whole thing to bed after talking with Dr. Siegel, but I think I actually have enough questions that we could do this for another, 15 or 20 minutes. So we will probably have Dr. Michael Siegel back on the program at some point in the near future. And I do appreciate him sitting down and talking here. I don't think that Dr. Siegel is one of those who is just interested in repealing the Second Amendment and let's have a gun-free United States. In fact, I was pleasantly surprised to hear that his views have changed as he has, done more research on this. I'm glad to see and hear that. But I do wish that I had been able to, that you and I had both been able to hear his response to, doing equal work in blue states. And in fact, I would argue that, again, if you're trying to build credibility among gun owners, you need to go after the blue states first, right? And I am pretty sure that what Dr. Siegel was saying is, listen, we weren't calling for any of those things. Blue states are certainly free to get rid of those laws. But again, I think, if you are wanting to present this as, okay, here's the big compromise. And look, we're doing these things in such a way that we are trying to respect people's Second Amendment rights. Well, a compromise doesn't just involve, okay, red states, here are some carefully crafted universal background check laws, red flag laws, laws regarding prohibited persons. That's not a compromise. That may be a compromise on the part of people who want to see universal background checks, red flag laws, and prohibited person laws in place, right? Okay, or the compromise is we're going to narrowly craft these things so that we think they're more likely that red states will accept them. But that's not the compromise that gun owners are looking for. In fact, I would argue that gun owners aren't necessarily looking for a compromise. But if you, again, want to build credibility that, hey, we're not actually out to take your guns, we're not out to destroy the Second Amendment. Well, again, I think in addition to telling red states, hey, here are some laws we think will save lives, and we think you should put them in place, I think you have to be talking to blue states and saying, hey, here's what you're doing wrong. Here are the laws that you are pushing that don't save lives. Here are the laws that you're pushing that wrongly incarcerate people, saddle them with felony convictions so they can't get a good job going forward. I think that is critical for a group like Bridging the Divide. And I mentioned Wisconsin because there was a story in the Wisconsin Journal Sentinel that talked about this group trying to present these ideas to Democrat and Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin. They were kind of viewing that as the test case, right? Because I think Wisconsin has a divided legislature. I think Democrats control the Senate and Republicans control the House, I believe. I would have loved to have seen Dr. Siegel testify against the so-called assault ban that Democrats in Virginia were pushing this session. and tell these Democrats, hey, this is wrong. You're not going to accomplish anything. Go after the magazine ban, right? I just think that if you want to make a play for red states and you want to make the argument that, hey, we have, you know, carefully crafted these bespoke laws in such a way that we don't think that it infringes on anybody's Second Amendment rights. And at the same time, we think that there are all of these laws out there that do. The goal cannot simply be, let's get more of these laws that we think will be effective in place in red states. You have to spend, if not equal time, I think you have to spend more time. And I think you first have to say, blue states, you're doing it wrong. You're not saving lives, you're hurting people. These policies, even these policies like the universal background check laws, the red flag laws that are in place in New York or Colorado, the prohibited person statutes, these are too broad. And you need to scale them back. You need to adopt our policies here. And unless and until this group is going to put forth the same effort to improve the laws in blue states, I think it's going to be way too easy, rightly or wrongly, to dismiss this group as, again, just another gun control group that's tailoring its message for red states. And I'll ask Dr. Siegel the next time we have him on the program. I don't think that's what Dr. Siegel wants for this group. I certainly don't think that's what David Yamane wants this group to be, or Rob Pincus, or any of the other Second Amendment supporters who are a part of this group. I don't think they want it to be a gun control group for red states. But if that's all you're advocating for, well, that's all you're going to be, right? All right. On to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. Before we do that, I do want to thank Dr. Siegel, and I do want to thank David Yamane, and I do want to thank everybody else who was a part of this program. I don't think, not everybody. There are some folks, and this is one of the questions I did not have a chance to talk with Dr. Siegel about. There are some folks there who I genuinely don't respect. I just don't. Won't name any names, but rhymes with Shmonathan Shmlawi. And I just can't bring myself to say thank you to Shmonathan Shmlawi for being a part of this program. But I do believe that the vast majority of participants here are not interested in eradicating our Second Amendment rights. I think that they are looking for a way, as Dr. Siegel said, to have, you know, carefully tailored laws that are designed to have a significant impact on violent crime, suicide prevention, and accidents involving firearms while respecting people's Second Amendment rights. Do I believe that respect goes far enough? In many cases, I do not. Are there ways to make these things even better? I think so. Can I endorse the document that they came up with as a whole? I cannot. But that doesn't mean that I think they're all a bunch of gun-grabbing commies either. There is some nuance to be found here. All right. And I hope that, again, we can continue the conversation with Dr. Siegel going forward. Okay. Now, on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. Let's start there with a case out of Baltimore, Maryland, where police say a 14-year-old with a lengthy criminal history struck a police vehicle while behind the wheel of a stolen vehicle. How about that? This happened, I guess, last week, April 1st, about 1 o'clock in the morning. The stolen vehicle and the 14-year-old was trying to get away from police when they struck a cruiser. They ended up in a dead end and hitting the patrol vehicle once again. Passenger then got out of the car, ran off into the darkness, has not been found, but the 14-year-old behind the wheel was taken into custody. 14 years old. Again, police say she has a lengthy criminal history, stolen auto, robbery, aggravated assault. Fox 45 talked with a woman who lives in the area, identified as Ms. Sharon. And I think we need to elect Ms. Sharon to the legislature in Maryland. She said that she thinks the juvenile justice system is failing to deter repeat offenders. She says, I think everything's fun. So that's what it is. And they know they're just going to get a slap on the wrist. They're going to go out to their parents, even if they have a monitor. They don't care. She said, juvenile justice, it's a big joke. And she's right. She's right. And not just in Maryland. You know, this is something that a lot of states are wrestling with at the moment. The juvenile justice system is not meant to incarcerate or warehouse teens or children until they become adults. Right. The primary goal of the juvenile justice system is rehabilitation. But unfortunately, a lot of these systems have sort of forgotten that one of the tools of rehabilitation is there being punishment, consequences for actions. Let's put it that way. Not even punishment. Consequences for actions. And when the consequences for criminal actions are so minor that they are an inconvenience for these juveniles, well, those consequences aren't going to have much of an impact, are they? So if you steal a car, you ram that car into a gun store, you and your buddies run in, you take as many guns as you can carry out in 60 seconds, you get into another stolen vehicle and you drive off, and you're pulled over a mile down the road, and police find you in the stolen vehicle, and they find the stolen guns, and you're released to your parents that same night and told to show up in court in a couple of weeks, at which time you'll be offered a plea deal that will result in doing some community service. Maybe you wear an ankle monitor that may or may not actually be monitored, and that's it. What lesson are those teens going to take away from that experience? And by the way, it's not really a hypothetical. That's based on what happened in New York last year in one of these gunshot burglaries. So it is not surprising to me that the 14-year-old behind the wheel has a lengthy criminal history, because I'm guessing this 14-year-old has never really suffered any major consequences for those crimes, which include robbery and aggravated assault. And if I'm being honest, she's probably not going to suffer any consequences this time around either. On to today's armed citizen story from Chicago, where a Chicago man fatally shot an alleged home invader in the South Deering neighborhood. Now, we don't have a lot of information on this because it happened Monday morning, just a few hours ago. What we do know is that police were called out to a home in that neighborhood, in the 2200 block of East 103rd Street in Chicago. Got a call about a person who was shot. When they got there, they found a man inside a home with a gunshot wound to the chest. That individual was pronounced deceased at the scene. The 33-year-old who lives there at the home told officers that the person had entered his home, charged towards him, which is when the resident opened fire. We don't know if this was a random encounter or if the intruder knew the individual. We don't know how the intruder got into the home, whether he, you know, kicked in a door, whether the door was unlocked. We don't have a lot of information here. Investigation obviously continues. We will hopefully get more information in the days to come. But at last report, police had not arrested the homeowner. They are treating this as an act of self-defense. If anything else changes, we will certainly bring that to your attention. And finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A pizzeria owner in Queens who saved customers from a man armed with a box cutter who had apparently threatened staff there at the restaurant. News Nation reporting on the incident. This happened last Wednesday about 9 o'clock. At a place called the Louis Pizza, which is run by Louis Lujovic. And he told the WPIX, he said, I had a couple customers in front when this guy came in. And an older woman says to me, he has a knife. And he's like cursing us out. He's telling us, give me food. Give me this. So I gave him a slice of pizza, he said. Guy leaves, but then the guy comes back, and Soljovic said he's even more hostile and irate at that point. Police say the individual, 34-year-old Jose Guadfebles, allegedly threatened a 41-year-old employee of Louis Pizza with a box cutter. Louis believed that his employee, as well as the customers, were in danger, so he jumped on Guadfebles, who then runs to the front of the restaurant, smashes into the glass door, shatters the glass door, allegedly told Louis, "I'll kill you," after he slammed into the door. Thankfully, Soljovic was able to subdue Guadfebles until officers arrived and were able to take him into custody. Some of Louis' customers talked with the WPIX in New York and said this is not the first time that he's actually, you know, stepped up to save the day. One customer said that he's stopped a robbery in the past. Guadfebles, by the way, again, arrested by police. He was taken to court. He was arraigned, pled not guilty, and was released without bail. So just already back out on the streets. Where he may very well do something like this again. Because again, where are the consequences, right? Now, again, I understand. Not everybody should be held behind bars without bail until they go to trial. Not everybody should be able to just walk out on their own recognizance either. I know the argument against cash bail. I know that it disproportionately hurts those on the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder. I get that. And maybe it doesn't need to be cash bail. Maybe we'll come up with some other way for that for these individuals to have some skin in the game. Rather than just, you know, I give my word, Your Honor, I'll show up in court. I'm willing to sit down and have a conversation with criminal justice advocates. Maybe we can bridge the divide in the criminal justice system by coming up with some way that some middle ground, right? It's not just, walk out on your own recognizance. It's not hold everybody until they go to trial. Some way for individuals like Guadfebles to be incentivized to show up in court, to be incentivized to stay on the straight and narrow and not allegedly do things like this. That, however, is a topic for another day. And I do thank you for being a part of the conversation today. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Not sure what our conversation will be. We won't continue this with Dr. Siegel tomorrow. We'll give it a little bit of a breathing room here, but do want to ask you, in addition to checking out today's show, and thank you for that, be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day today, because we are keeping up to date on a number of important things, including the frustrating news from the Supreme Court, also the First Circuit deciding that the right to keep and bear arms does not include the right to acquire one, which sets up a deepening circuit court split on the issue of waiting periods. John Petrolino has a piece on the NRA Board of Directors elections. And we've got the latest segment of news from all across the nation waiting for you. If you like what you see there at Bearing Arms, I would also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, and VIP Platinum member. Use the promo code FIGHT, and you can get 60% off your membership. You will get great benefits no matter what tier of support you choose. Obviously, the benefits increase as the tiers go up. But no matter which tier you choose, you'll be supporting the work we're doing at Bearing Arms. And I want to thank you for that very much. Have a great rest of your Monday. We'll see you back here tomorrow for 2A Tuesday. Until then, be well, be safe.